This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On Saturday, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir is holding a gala concert to celebrate its 75 years on radio with its music and the spoken word broadcasts. The history of music in Mormonism extends beyond their most famous musical group. In fact, music has always been an important part of shaping the identity of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Joining us now to talk about it is Michael Hicks. He's a professor in the BYU School of Music. He's written extensively on music history, including the book Mormonism and Music, and is joining us this morning from his office in Provo. And Dr. Michael Hicks, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Nice to be with you.
There's a passage from Psalms in the Bible that you quote early in your book that expresses what you call the ironies of music and religion. Could you talk about that?
Remind me the passage that you're...
Well, the passage talks about hanging the harps in the willows.
Yes. Yeah, when you're in captivity, and how can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? There is a constant question for Mormons about their identity. Certainly in the 19th century, there was that feeling of being strangers in America. And, of course, eventually, for a variety of reasons, the Latter-day Saints left the United States and tried to establish, in effect, their own nation based on the Kingdom of God.
Yeah.
And now in the 20th century, well, now the 21st century, the quest has been mainly to become a part of American culture, and certainly the Tabernacle Choir has succeeded perhaps best in doing that for the church and creating a certain kind of image for the church, that and the missionaries on bicycles, I suppose, but... there's always some kind of conflict about, what should we be singing? Can we really sing what's in our hearts when we're in this strange place? I'm not sure how strange America seems to Mormons now, but in the 19th century, it was obviously the case that they were uncomfortable there and so had to go somewhere else.
Well, one of the things you write about is that, on one hand, the self-denial of many religions has historically discouraged the pleasures of music, which
Absolutely.
Is so difficult, I expect, because music is such a part of, as you write in the book, man's profoundest utterances.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on what you mean by music, because there's music for voices. That's, music with text, in other words.
Yeah.
Which you can get away with in any religion, in a way, because the meaning of the words and the proclaiming of the message of the religion can always overcome any questions about the pleasure that one might be illegitimately getting from the musical sounds. But instrumental music is a separate issue, really. And, if you think about the statue of Moroni on the temples of the LDS Church, he's playing a trumpet or some kind of brass instrument, but you can't play a brass instrument, or you're not supposed to, in LDS sacrament meeting.
Right.
So, there's the image of music as proclaiming.
Yeah.
That's what the angel Moroni is doing, in a way. That's a symbol of him proclaiming his message. But the actual sound is another issue, and we're kind of uncomfortable unless it's vocal music. That's why, choirs and the vocal tradition and obviously hymn singing have been an essential part of the Mormon musical identity from the beginning and many Christian churches. But that's why I say it depends on what you mean by music.
Yeah.
Because vocal music in Christianity has always been accepted. Instrumental music has had a real long and hard road in Christian worship. Let me say something about that a little more. We talk about Protestantism, and of course the idea of Protestants is that they're protesting something. And we don't normally think about the fact that the early Protestants, many of them at least, in Europe and definitely in this country, where the Protestantism was even more severe in some cases, was protesting music, at least the high church traditions of music and specifically of choirs in Catholicism and state churches. And so there was a real strong feeling and absolutely among early Mormons, the earliest Mormons anyway, a feeling against choirs, that that was really part of the tradition that they, as primitivist religionists, you'd say, or primitivist Christians, were trying to get away from in order to get back to the true church, which didn't have choirs. But that, that changed, obviously, partly because of Joseph Smith's father, who really liked choirs and was interested in singing from a printed page, printed music, and a lot of Christians and a lot of early Mormons had some trouble with that, but obviously we know who won out in the end.
Yeah, well, why? Because it seemed rote or too ostentatious for directly dealing with this accessible God, do you think? Is that what they were reacting to?
Well, the feeling was that singing should come from the heart.
Huh.
And, you know, if you're singing from the heart, you can't be locked to a printed page. And the other objection with choirs was that that was an elitist tradition. The trained people got to sing, but the rest of us had to just listen. And the feeling was, you know, everyone should be involved in worship through singing. And but the reason that choirs succeeded, I think there's a number of reasons, and certainly the Tabernacle Choir is a good example of that as well. These reasons have to do with, as I say, a shift in the population of the church and the interest in having a more formal kind of tradition. This really was associated initially with the Kirtland Temple, and moving to that kind of really more formal and more elaborate kind of worship, and that made choirs seem more accessible and acceptable. Also, as years went by, and certainly by the end of the 19th century, it was clear that if we had really good choirs, that showed the world that Mormons actually could do things well. And, we had a huge reputation-saving issue. We're trying to salvage our reputation in the United States and in the world at large, who really had, you know, demonized the Mormons quite a bit. And if we could sing good choral music, sing choral music well, that went a long way to showing that, you know, we had some ability and we were pursuing excellence. And because it was vocal music, then we could also, you know, sing our message, as it was said, sing our message into the hearts of the people.
Well, a fact that not misplaced by some who were suspicious of the fact that this was this choir was somehow a ploy to change people's opinions and to proselyte.
Absolutely.
this strange gospel, I guess, that was a real obstacle for the choir in early days, I expect.
It was, and it was particularly when the choir had its sort of, you know, seminal changeover from a little regional group to a group that was known on the national stage. This had to do with the 1892 Chicago World's Fair, where they had a choral competition the following year, in 1893, in connection with the World's Fair. And the Tabernacle Choir, to everyone's surprise, but in different directions, took second place. I say everyone's surprised in different directions because the people who were not in the church, who saw this happen, thought there's something wrong here. There was some kind of fixing of the jury to have gotten this Mormon choir such a high standing in the contest. And the Mormon leaders felt like it was rigged, that they should have won first place, but the anti-Mormon sentiment prevented them from doing that. So, anyway, there's always been a lot, well, I shouldn't say always, less and less over the years, but at that point in time, it was really shocking thing, I think, to a lot of Americans that this Mormon choir had emerged from, you know, at that time, still not a state.
Yeah. From the wilderness.
Utah Territory.
Yeah. So does music for the faithful, has it always had this inherent purpose, that is, preaching the Mormon gospel to the world? Or did they ever see it as extending beyond that? I mean, was that its basic purpose?
You know, that's a very good question. I do think that as time went on, if you look at the church, even from the Kirtland days, the earliest years there, into Nauvoo, and then into Salt Lake, there was more and more of an embrace of all truth and of beauty in connection with truth. And so we could embrace the pleasures of music because that was part of beauty, which was an adjunct to truth. And so that aspect of music became more and more acceptable. So it wasn't just proclaiming. But I will say that if you look at, by and large, the Mormon musical market, that is, people who market music, their songs specifically, to a Mormon audience,
yeah,
it really is message-oriented. It's devotional music to a large extent. And it's not necessarily in pursuit of the most transcendent beauty. Boy, there's an understatement. Sorry. But it's really about getting right to the message,
yeah,
whether it's confessional or adorational or whatever it might be, doctrinal. The message really, trumps the music.
It's so interesting, that tension that you write about between music and the message. And one of those great characters who seemed to have his own kind of problems with that tension was Evan Stevens,
mm-hmm,
a wildly passionate musician, I gather.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, did his vision for the choir match that of the hierarchy of the church all the time?
Well, it's hard to say. He really was a unique individual and someone whose legacy, I think, cannot be underestimated in the church, or should not be underestimated, I say, because he had notions of quality choral singing rooted in his Welsh heritage, and had a real sense of grandeur about the choir, and he's the one that really got it to the big size that we think of the Tabernacle Choir being. But he also was someone who was very interested in his own individual contribution to the music of Mormonism and the presentation of the message. So a lot of Evan Stevens is very much about Evan Stevens. I think that the choir and his own music, his hymns, and his actually somewhat more elaborate pieces, oratorios, and so on, these were his family. He was a bachelor lifelong, and in a church that was interested in family and plural families, in fact, very large families, and he was this one lone person. And so he devoted really all of his life to creating, as much as he could, a Mormon musical culture, to some extent in his own image. So, yes, he was interested in quality as measured by, you might say, by the East Coast.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also in having this newness that he represented as a faithful Mormon. In other words, there's always this sense that we have to not just reach the standards established by the world, but we have to create new standards and new kinds of sounds. So it was really both for Evan Stevens, who was really quite an amazing person whose imprint is still literally throughout the Mormon hymn book. and even his attitudes still present, I think.
Was it at all particularly significant or even controversial when the choir started doing more, you know, classical work, less than just religious hymns?
Well, I think so. I think that you know, for Mormons listening to the choir, there was among some, I get the sense at least, of a slight feeling, or maybe a large feeling of betrayal, that the music was, as I said before, trumping the message in some way, and that we should be more overtly proclaiming the LDS gospel, the restored gospel. But the counterbalancing value, of course, was the ability to, as I said before, demonstrate our not just competence, but real strength in music. Mm. And that, especially when it got to the realm of broadcasting, 1929, which we're celebrating now, the 75th anniversary, that there had to be a common language with the world outside, and we had to show off in a way, in a nice way, show off what we could do.
So how does music beyond the Mormon Tabernacle Choir too, though, fit into the Mormon notion of centralizing the Mormon experience? You know, there was a time in Mormon history when I can't remember the exact word. They began to consolidate all of the kinds of programs. Mm-hmm. So church members, for example, I've heard leaders saying that they want, for example, church members who worship in sub-Saharan Africa, mm-hmm. to have the same kind of experience, up to the music, mm-hmm. as those in the Mill Creek ward of Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
Did music fit into that idea of did they want that experience to be the same as well? I guess.
Well, thus far, yes, that's been the direction. But you can't. One thing that I think anyone learns, certainly any church learns, is that you can only regulate music to a point. Yeah. Obviously, you can't regulate it very well in the individual lives of church members, because there's been there was anti-ragtime advocacy and anti-jazz polemics for years, and anti-rock and roll, and all of those things have pervaded to some extent the lives of LDS members, similarly to those outside of the church. But even regulating music in the church has not been so easy. Obviously, Mormon pop music finds its way into LDS meetings despite advice or counsel not to do so, not to use that kind of music. And in the other countries and the other lands and among other peoples, as you're suggesting, there are instinctive ways of changing the music, even as closely regulated as it may be by the leadership of the church, and by the way, that is a leadership and a direction that's promulgated quite a bit by broadcasting in the church now too, through satellites and so on. But if you go to sub-Saharan Africa, for example, and they're singing a song like "Love at Home," there is beauty all around when there's love at home. There's little syncopations that get added in frequently because that's part of their culture. So there's always some tinge of the local culture. At some point, whether we'll really embrace as a church the indigenous musics, the styles, that could really, bring a greater, obviously greater breadth of expression to worship, that remains to be seen. And that's another tension that goes back to the original question you asked about that psalm. Mm. You know, what is the Lord's song exactly?
Yeah.
What's the strange land? And is it a strange song or what?
Yeah. Well, forget about the choir for a moment. I want to know what influence Gladys Knight is having on the Mormon Church. I mean, we should probably explain that Gladys Knight, that Gladys Knight that you're thinking of, formerly with the Pips, is now a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I suppose I'm asking that question somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but is she in some way a reflection of maybe music that may be changing within Mormonism?
Well, part of me wanted to say I hope so, but... And I do,
yeah.
But it is a very good question, and you would be surprised. I've had two other people ask me within the last 2 weeks that very question.
Wow.
Because, you know, she is directing a choir in, I think, the Las Vegas area, rooted in the Las Vegas area, Saints Unified Voices.
Yeah.
It's a gospel choir.
Sure.
And is touring amongst Latter-day Saints. And there is this weird reaction to them in which the Latter-day Saint audiences are loving it and feeling a little guilty, like, should I be clapping to this music?
Yeah.
Should I be shouting? How should I be feeling to this? Because it's actually, obviously, praise-oriented music, gospel-oriented music. I mean, it's called gospel music.
Sure.
And... But is it restored gospel or is it a bad gospel?
Right.
But people can't help but respond because it's all about praise, and that's a dimension of musical worship that we have not really had in the LDS Church, partly because of its cultural origins. Praise, that sense of really uninhibited, you know, the David dancing before the ark. Mm. Kind of thing that you see in the Old Testament, where he's saying praise the Lord with a trumpet and with all these other things, the psaltery, the harp, the loud cymbals, and all of that. We haven't quite gotten to that point yet, but I think that Gladys Knight is having a really interesting, that's as much as I can say, as strong an adjective as I can say right now, but an interesting effect there.
Dr. Michael Hicks, he is a professor in the BYU School of Music and the author of the book Mormonism and Music, A History. And he joined us from his office in Provo. And Dr. Hicks, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed by Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Diane Wanamaker. Produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
On the next Fresh Air, Hendrik Hertzberg, a staff writer and editor for The New Yorker magazine. He's been described by editor David Remnick as the magazine's principal political voice. Hertzberg has a new book called Politics, collecting his writing from 1966 to 2004. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.